So today we're going to be talking about interviewing, how to interview well. And thankfully we have Lisa Evans with us. She has 20 years of experience with recruiting and HR. So she's very well aware of the interview process, and she's helped countless people to do well on their interviews. She's coached before. So we're going to get to hear her tips and her insights on what exactly a program director and the whole committee, the people you're going to be interviewing, what is going through their heads? What are they looking for? How can you give your answers in a way that will really put you in the best light and help you to stand out as a candidate that they would want at their school? So thanks again for being with us, Lisa. You know, I first wanted to say something about how important the interview is, and what some people may not, you know, realize is even if you have a great GPA, even if you have a great personal statement, you've done all the right things up until this point. You've worked for 7, 8, 9, 10 years towards this goal of being a CRNA. You still have to pass that interview. And some people naturally interview well. Some people have a harder time. But everyone with practice and the right tips can do much, much better and can actually do well. So we're going to learn some of those tips today. So Lisa, go ahead and start off by telling us what is the goal of the interview. What are they looking for? What are they trying to determine when they're asking all these questions?
Right. Well, the most important thing to remember is the school is primarily looking for students who will successfully complete the program. So that's what they're assessing during the interview. It's not a job interview, so it's not necessarily how well you've performed in your career to date, but how likely you are to successfully complete the program, which is why they ask you about all of those personal areas, such as your financial outlook, how you're going to take care of your finances and manage those throughout the program, and the academic rigor. Can you apply yourself? Do you have the support in your life emotionally and enough brain space to buckle down and get it done?
Yeah, great perspective. I think that's important to know going into it, that, you know, that's their objective, that's their goal, that's what you have to convince them that you can do. So I know that we, you know, on a recent call, there was a gentleman who might have been a great student. I'm sure he had, you know, he had a high GPA, he had a great experience, but when you asked him about finances, he didn't have a solid plan. And when I was listening to his answer, I thought, oh, I don't think that's going to fly with the committee. That one question, you know, I don't think, you know, unless he changed his answer, unless he thought it through and got a better, more solid answer, I don't think they were going to pick him, because it sounded doubtful that he'd be able to continue to finish the program. And that's an important, you know, it's important. They need to know that you can.
That's right. Specifically in the area of finances, you have to demonstrate how you're going to do it. And that can't be just an idea or a thought. It has to be an actual plan. The more thoroughly you plan in advance, and even writing it down, taking it with you to the interview so that when you're asked about it, you can say, yes, I've thought long and hard about this. I've talked with my family members, if that's true. Maybe you've arranged for student loans or financial aid or assistance from a family member. Maybe you'll live with a family member during your program, depending on the school you're interviewing with at that time. So you want to show them that your plan, that you know how you're going to pay your monthly bills, how you're going to have money for expenses, because they're assessing viability, right? It's not just can you say you can do it, but how is it going to pan out? How is it going to work if you will be depending on a spouse or other family member for financial support throughout the program? We know everyone has to know that that's a variable. What if that person loses their income? What will you do then? And what will you do if the car breaks down during this time? Is that part of your budget? Have you thought about that? Do you have a fallback for that? Because student loans can cover a lot, but they really won't cover if your car breaks down.
Right.
And if you're in school and commuting to that school, they're going to be able to tell very quickly, oh, you're going to have to travel 26 miles to get to our school if you come here. You're going to need a car or public transportation. This is all part of your plan. Mm-hmm. So in your plan that you write up, even just for yourself, you should do this for yourself first and then be ready to share the summary version of it, of how you'll cover your expenses during that time and know you'll be okay.
And saying phrases like, oh, I'll probably get loans or something, is not a solid answer, because you could have, your credit's not good enough. Maybe you're already maxed out with credit. And, that's not an option for everybody. If it's an option for you, that's great. Make sure it is before you say that, so that you can say with confidence, I plan on taking $80,000 out in school loans. I'm going to take I have another $20,000 in savings. And if that's not enough, my parents are going to pitch in an extra $10,000, and that should be more than what I need. And that's the type of answer that they want, is something concrete, measurable, something very detailed and planned out. So yeah, I think that's a great answer.
Specific.
Exactly.
For student loans, you're going to get them through this institution, whichever bank or group is facilitating it. If it's financial aid, then you want to say what kind of financial aid, through what services. Is it a grant? Is it a scholarship? Is it a special, loan? Or in one instance, we had someone who was planning to go to work for the government, I think. And so his loans would be forgiven.
Oh, okay.
So if that program is something that you're looking into, then you say that as well. I'm going to I'm going to rack up all this in student loans, because they're not just going to want to see that you have the loans, but that you know how that you're going to be able to pay them back.
Right.
So, because that's all part of the viability of being able to complete the program and having those loans be good, is to say the plan, and if I go to work for this company, they have tuition reimbursement, or if I work for this organization, then they forgive my loans after 10 years of service, or whatever the case may be. Just be very specific and be prepared to talk about it and answer questions about it, and not to feel you can't know the answer. You can't know. I'm going to segue a little bit into what you can't know. Things you can't know in the interview. You can't ever tell what they think. Even when you think you know, there's still a chance you don't. They're all human. Everyone in the room will be a human, just like us, just like me and you and everyone else. So they could be having a bad day. They could have had a death in the family and they just learned about it. They could be going through divorce. They could have a sick child. They could have a terrible relationship with their boss or a coworker. Mm. All of these things are coming into the room with them that have nothing to do with you. So don't try and guess. Just like you, when we're in any interaction, even a social interaction, there's always thinking going on both sides. What do they think of me? He didn't seem to like that, or she didn't like that, or I think she really liked me. You can't really tell until the next thing happens. You can't know for sure until they either will admit you or they won't, and you won't get to know why unless they tell you, and even then you won't get to know all of the reasons why, because so many of them are not things we would write down.
Right.
You or I or anyone in a professional setting, we would not write down if someone picked their nose, for instance. We probably wouldn't write that down. Maybe we would. Or if they, any number of things that they're not going to write down, such as if you lick your lips a lot.
Would those things really exclude you from a program?
Sure. You never know. This is what I'm saying. These are more things you can't know what each individual is bringing into that room. Just like they don't know what we're bringing into the room. All of our triggers, right? For past traumas, past successes, past indicators of certain behaviors that we don't like. If one of our parents had a bad habit of licking their lips and it was embarrassing to us, we might really not like people who do that. Or we would feel so sorry. It goes on and on and on and on and on.
So,
all
right,
the things people won't write down.
Okay.
So you can't know. So let it go. Gone. You can't know, so don't try to control it. So what can you do when you know you're nervous? There's a few things you can do. And the primary objective is to get yourself back to that ideal state of being calm and focused for the task at hand, which is your interview. When you feel yourself getting nervous, maybe your palms get sweaty, maybe you start fiddling with a pen or shaking your feet, tapping your feet, shaking your legs, here's some direction you can give your brain to know what to do so it doesn't start filling in with all the scary, terrible things it knows could happen. So feeling yourself in the chair, this is my mantra. My feet are on the floor, my butt is in the chair, and I can feel the back of the chair on my back. And that's 1, 2, 3 check-ins with yourself on multiple levels. One is physical, that you're feeling your body physically in the chair. The other is tuning in your focus to feeling your feet on the floor, feeling your butt in the chair, feeling the back of the chair on your back. Those are 3 points. By the time you've checked those 3 points, you should be back in the room, back and focused on the task at hand.
So Lisa, we've talked about nerves, and I know one thing for me that can really affect me is if I'm hungry. However, I don't usually like to eat when I'm stressed. So it's confusing to me. What do you do before an interview with food? You know, you never know how long the interview is going to go. I don't know. What would you tell somebody for how should they eat the day of the interview, and what should they do in terms of preparation for food?
That is a great question. I'm so glad you asked. The rule of thumb is to eat a substantial meal. You don't want to be over full, but you want it to be substantial. Like if you were to have a Sunday brunch or a substantial dinner, you want to eat a meal like that that ends about an hour before your interview so that your body has all the fuel it needs. Because when our bodies run out of fuel, it causes distraction for our minds. And our minds are supposed to be focused, calm and focused on the task at hand, which is getting through the interview and interviewing well. So making sure your body has that fuel is really important so that your body's not distracting you with hunger pains or hunger sounds while you're in the interview. And sometimes we know that you should get an itinerary of some sort that lets you know how long you're going to be there, how long the interview will last, and what will happen while you're there. And you should prepare based on what they provide you, and then double or triple it and be prepared for that. So you always want to be prepared to walk more than you think you're going to walk. So you want to have shoes that you can walk in case they do a tour, an impromptu tour, or maybe there's a visitor, a special visitor that day, and so the location for your interview has moved from where you thought it was going to be to all the way on the other side of campus. So you want to have comfortable shoes, shoes that you can walk in, and you want to have a snack. You want to arm yourself with a snack so that you don't worry about food. If the interview takes longer than it's scheduled to, or you find that all that interviewing has just wore you out, it does burn calories, and so you need a snack. You want to know that you have one that you can get to quickly and without making a mess, and that will not overfill you. So something that travels well, nuts, a banana that you haven't squeezed too much or too hard. You shouldn't need a utensil for it, but you should bring a napkin just in case. And then, of course, do that check right after you eat anything for an interview. You want to check that you don't have anything in your teeth.
That's great advice. I did talk to a girl who had interviewed, and she said that in the email she got with the invitation, or the letter she got with the invitation, it said that the interview would last an hour. So she didn't eat breakfast, figured she'd grab something at the end of the interview. And then it was 4 hours before they even saw her. So had she followed your advice, she would have been okay. She would have had a snack and she would have eaten breakfast about an hour before. She would have been okay, but instead all she could think about was her stomach rumbling during the interview, and it was so distracting to her. She could hardly focus. Yeah. And this is such a big deal. Yeah. This interview is such a big deal, and it affects so much of your life that you don't want something so solvable like food to be the reason you didn't get in. So yeah, these are things you can think of and do ahead of time. Make sure you're prepared so that something like this doesn't affect you for the rest of your life, just a simple missed meal. could have more impact than we want it to. So yeah, thank you for your answer, Lisa. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Now, what about when we're meeting interviewers, when you're, you know, when someone's introduced to someone that they've never met before and they're feeling anxious, how can they best interact with that new person in a way that will leave a positive impression?
Sure, absolutely. This can be daunting both in the interview setting and in any other professional setting where you're meeting people who are above your rank. Maybe they're a director, a VP, or an executive. My best advice for staying calm in that moment and present and confident but not cocky or arrogant is to pretend like you've known them, you've met them before in the past, you just don't remember what they look like. So you're really just seeing them again in your mind. Tell yourself, I know this person, I've met them before, I just don't remember what they look like. And that's how you can kind of trick your brain into giving you real emotions so that you come off as being authentic with a smile on your face, that you're happy to see them again. Like, oh, it's really nice to see you again, even though it's not again. That's how you bring in that energy of authenticity to be warm and welcoming when you shake their hand. And it's very common for people to say, hi, how are you? When they shake your hand, or it's nice to meet you. And so having your key phrases prepared that you're comfortable with, that are gracious and keeps that dialogue professional and courteous, but not opening up to a big, broad conversation because that's not what you're there to do. So if someone says, hi, how are you? Typically we would say, I'm well, thanks, or I'm good, how are you? But we don't have to say that. We don't have to say a second question. We can just say, I'm very well, thank you. Or you can say, I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me today. Or I'm doing good. I'm happy I made the interview. I'm happy to be invited to be here. And that's a nice thing to say. It's courteous. It provides a segue. It also ends it. So they're not expected to say anything else after that. There's no expectation to answer your questions or you asking how they are. None of those things need to happen. You can just say, I'm well, thank you. But your greeting is warm. It's genuine. Your handshake is firm but not crushing, and the best way to measure that is to think about shaking the hand of somebody whose hand is made out of bananas. You can be firm, you can feel their whole hand in your hand, but you're not trying to squeeze to the point where it would cause them pain or cause a banana to squish out of its peel. That's too much.
I absolutely love that visual. I've never heard that before. That is perfect.
Yeah, keep that banana nice and intact.
Oh, what a colorful way to remember it. I will never forget that as long as I live.
Because it's hard to know, right? People say, oh, you want a firm handshake. A firm handshake is really good. It's a positive thing. And then there's many interpretations of firm. And what is firm? Firm is a subjective thing. So just imagine there's a banana. And that way you're firm, but not crushing.
I absolutely love that. Thanks, Lisa. So how about how to answer questions well? Of course, one thing we know is that there's no way we can possibly prepare for every question that they're going to be asked. But you can prepare, you know, there's 20% of preparation that will give you 80% of results. That's the Pareto principle that I live by. There's always a 20-80 ratio, and you want to always do the 20% of the work that's going to get you the 80% of the results. You never want to be on the other side of that doing 80% of the work that gets you 20% of the results. And just real briefly, let me explain what part of the work you can do to prepare for the interview that is that 20%. And it's getting your mindset right. It's getting, you know, putting yourself in the right, having the right perspective and the right kind of global ideas, not the details, the nitty gritty. That would be the 80%. That would be going over in detail all these clinical questions. And, you know, I know people have stayed up. I've talked to people who've, you know, studied 2 days straight on all these clinical questions. And I think that's focusing on the wrong thing. So what are some global ideas, some big concepts that we can do to prepare for these questions without having to know every single question we're going to get asked, but just to get our mindset in the right place and to have kind of the right idea about it. So what are some general tips you can give, Lisa?
Sure. Well, those setting that foundation to be able to answer any question is, to your point, mission critical and is the work you can do on just a few things that will have a broad impact across many different types of questions and from different people who are asking those questions. So the first rule of thumb is you always want to end questions on a positive note. Where you know you've answered a question incorrectly, you can turn that into a positive by first calming yourself down. And you can say, I feel like I didn't answer that question well. So I'm either going to research it when I get home, or I'm going to talk to a coworker, or I'm going to make a note of that. I'll be sure to never get that wrong again. You can say that to let them know that you're thinking beyond the failure, you're thinking beyond the mistake, and looking for ways to solve for that in the future, which is a positive. When questions are asked that are about your experience, your work history, your academic history, if they ask you situational or behavioral questions to ask, to tell them a time in which you struggled, or you worked for someone you didn't like, or you had a class that was hard to pass. Oftentimes interviewers will ask these kinds of questions to get a sense of what you do when things aren't going well. And these are behavioral questions, and so they're looking for a behavioral answer, not what you thought, but what you did. So you're going to be answering on the fly. You're not going to be able to prepare for the question they're asking you. So give yourself a moment after the question has been asked to think about what you're going to say, and of course, which story you're going to share. Because tell me about a time when, you're gonna have to go through your own history to find an example. And oftentimes the examples that come to mind are failures, because they're very clear in our mind. Don't ever do that again. So if a story of a failure comes to your mind and you find yourself deep in the weeds of a story that maybe doesn't have a happy ending, the positive spin you can do at the end of that is to, again, either say what you learned from it, what you did the next time, or how you worked, rearranged your thinking or your situation somehow so that the next time that kind of scenario plays out, you're in a better position to handle it so that it does have a positive outcome. And remembering that interviewers are human, and you can say, I'd really like to end this story on a positive note. You can say that that's what you're doing to give yourself more time. I'd really like to end this story on a positive note. And there's a few different ways I can talk about that. And you have to go from there. But you want to always be tactful wherever there's a sad or negative story. You want to be sure to not vilify the players. You want to always be tactful. If there was a boss or a professor or a coworker or someone from another department, a leader from another department who made your life hard, you can talk about that by using neutral language that doesn't vilify the other person, by saying, I was challenged when I worked with this person because I either didn't understand what they wanted, or I wasn't able to, you know, maybe I wasn't managing my time correctly to satisfy this person. Whatever that scenario is, the person isn't the bad guy. If you make them the bad guy, now the interviews focus on them, and that's inappropriate. So you want to remain tactful. The other players are not the main character in your stories because they're asking about you, what you did in a particular situation and how you got yourself out of it. So they're not the villain. You're not the hero or the victim. It's a very objective story about what happened. Just the facts, ma'am. And what you did to either succeed in the moment or prepare yourself so that it didn't happen again, or that if it did happen again, it would have a better outcome. So those are good foundational rules to think about. I'm going to end it on a positive. I'm going to keep all the players neutral. There's no villains. There's no victims. There's no bad guy. And
yeah,
and you'll be fine.
I think that's great, great general advice, because you can apply that to just about any one of those situations. And as long as you think through your stories ahead of time, then, you know, you can make sure to identify how you're going to portray each character in your story. And I actually would encourage that. Pick a few situations in your career that stand out, and you might plug those stories into any number of different questions. You know, think of a hard time, think of a positive time, think of, you know, just try and get a variety of different experiences that you've had that stand out, something unique happened, something. I mean, I know every nurse I've talked to has these stories that they like to share, they like to tell because they're interesting, something unique happened that day, interesting patient, something. And so have those stories on hand and then be able to apply them to different questions. I think that that's a good way of spending your time to prepare, even though you don't know exactly what questions that you'll get asked. Yeah, moving on to probably the number one most commonly asked question in the CRNA school interview is going to be, why do you want to be a CRNA? I feel like that's pretty foundational. I mean, you have to know the answer to that in order to spend the amount of time and effort that it takes to get into CRNA school to do the application. I mean, there's so many steps, and that's why so few people follow through and get to the finish line, because they get lost along the way. You know, there's so many steps where people can change their mind and say, no, that's too much work. Why did you stick it out? Why did you decide that this was important to you? So I guess, Lisa, the question to you is what, you know, how can they best prepare that answer, and what things should they avoid saying? What things, you know, should they include? Maybe give some guidance on that question.
Sure. That's a very good question, and it's important to the interview because, again, they're looking for people who are going to successfully complete their program. So your why, as to why you're there, is a really big part of them understanding whether or not you will be likely to complete the program successfully. Remembering that no matter what your story is of how you got there, the story will need to have three components. It has to have a beginning, it has to have a middle, and it has to have an ending. So when you think about this question, I highly recommend that you write this story down and that you tell it to a couple different people so that you can hear yourself say it out loud. How long does it take to say the answer, and does it flow correctly? Is it interesting? Sometimes we can approach something and give an answer that is accurate, chronological, and makes sense, but it's not very interesting. So it could be that if your why starts from your childhood, from an incident that inspired you to pursue this work, then you can go out of order to make the story more interesting. One of the things that always comes to mind for me with this kind of a question is to think about a headline. The headline of your story, which would be about the size of a tweet, should encapsulate the to be there with the patient front to back, start to finish. That's really important to me, so that you can go from there and maybe give an anecdote of a patient you worked with. You can start with that and then tell your why. It doesn't have to necessarily be, well, first I did this, and then I did that, and here's the end. It can be something interesting at the beginning. When I was 8 years old, this really interesting event happened, and I didn't think about it again until I was in college or until I was in nursing school. And then you go chronologically from there. But the components of having a beginning, a middle, and an end will help give structure to your story so that you're not meandering, and it gives you an opportunity to practice before that question is asked. You can ask people you know. I, again, recommend writing it down so that you can see the answer and think about it. And you can give yourself really quick cliff notes so you don't lose your place in your story. This is my beginning. Tell yourself whatever part of your story is the beginning. Label it the beginning, the middle, and the end, and you'll always know where you are. And you'll know about how much time it's going to take to answer. And you'll know when you're done and can pause and let the interviewer respond.
How much time should they take to answer this question or any question? I mean, what if they're practicing their answers ahead of time? Yeah, if they're timing it, what time should they shoot for?
A good rule of thumb is 2 minutes. It shouldn't take much more than 2 minutes to answer, to be able to provide an answer that will satisfy the question literally. And then there could be follow-up to that. So you don't want to be in a panic like, oh, well, now my complete answer is going to be over 2 minutes. No, it's just you don't want to be speaking for much more than 2 minutes without the interviewer having input because your time there is finite. So anything over 2 minutes, you're at risk of getting off track enough to affect the amount of time you have to spend with them. You always want to be sensitive to the interviewer. Some people really like to hear the candidates talk, but you want to check in with them.
I think that's a great rule of thumb, 2 minutes. I like that. It's very definite. Or the starting point anyways, of course, yeah, it doesn't have to be exactly that, but that's a good rule of thumb. So the next question is strengths and weaknesses. When someone asks, you know, what are your strengths and weaknesses? What are some pitfalls? I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of ways to mess that question up. There's probably some strategies to get it right. So help us with that.
Sure, absolutely. Well, naming both of those is hard for most people, and the way we evaluate ourselves can be quite different from the way we are viewed in the workplace. And even though this is an interview for an academic program, it will be your job for the next couple of years. So go ahead and treat it like a professional question of your strengths and weaknesses, and keep it that way, not personal. That's the first big no-no when someone says, what are your strengths and weaknesses, is to not talk about your personal, well, my kitchen's always a mess, or I don't walk my dogs enough. But those are out of context for the question. So a good way to get a handle on this for yourself in the weeks leading up to your interview are to ask your coworkers, your colleagues, to answer that in the blind. Don't give them too much to advance notice. Just say, I have to be answering questions soon, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to get asked what my strengths and weaknesses are. So I'll just ask you, what do you think my top two strengths are as a professional, and what do you see as my top two weaknesses or areas that I could improve on? And be ready for it. You know, we all have them, so just be ready for it and keep track and see if the same things come up from multiple people, you know you're really onto something. And if nothing else, even if they all give you different answers, it's all fodder for preparing your own answer to this question. And they are people, and they understand that you are doing a self-evaluation. And so they're just going to be getting a sense of, do you know yourself? And do you take constructive criticism well? If your answer comes out and it's clear that you haven't thought about it, that's what they will remember, that you haven't prepared an answer, that you didn't give yourself time and make the effort to be insightful about yourself as a professional and what trips you up on the regular. And that's what they're going to be listening for, right? This is my weakness. Whatever my weakness is, you're going to end that. It's a question, so you're going to end it on a positive. These are my weaknesses that have come out from my peers and in my own thinking about it. And I realize that maybe there's more work to do there, or these are the systems and tools and resources I've put in place to help me with those weak areas. And this is how I talk to my team about them. Whatever the story is, you want to be prepared with real information, not just guesses.
I really like the idea of asking their coworkers, or you know, anyone they work with, what their strengths and weaknesses are, because that gives something objective that isn't, you know, I don't know. I think it's hard for us to be objective about ourselves, but it's much easier, you know, so much easier to see someone else's strengths and weaknesses than it is to see our own. So, I mean, that does show preparation when you can share that. Hey, I asked my coworkers and this is what unanimously was said, or this is, you know, what came up a couple times and I feel like it resonates, that it is true. So, and yeah, it just gives some transparency and objectivity to the question. So I like that. What about the question, why did you choose our program over other programs? What happens when a person's applying to 10 schools and they really don't care where they get in? They would move anywhere. They really desperately want to be a CRNA and nothing is going to stop them. And so, you know, maybe they picked the program because it was the easiest to get into, or they, you know, they really wanted this other program, but they knew they didn't have a chance applying there. I mean, clearly, I think this question is easy to answer if you're going to your dream school. But for a lot of applicants, that's not the case. So how do you answer that question tactfully?
Sure, absolutely. Well, one of the things that everyone should be doing to prepare for their interview is researching the school online beyond the school's website. Because the school's website does a few things. It's functional in that it provides information and has probably some tools integrated in for communicating with staff or connecting with your cohort. But by and large, it is a marketing piece. So if all you do is research the website, you're going to sound like most of the other potential students who have just read the website. So the interviewers are hearing the same thing over and over and over and over. What you want to do is research the school beyond the website, on LinkedIn, on checking Google or whatever browser search engine you use, to find out their news, where they're in the news, from the community or from alumni associations, from the school itself, but on the web, not on their website. And give yourself a task to come up with two to five things you really like about that school. And those become your reason. It doesn't have to be your number one school for you to authentically be able to answer what it is you like about that school. Maybe it's the other programs that they offer, which makes the school more interesting to you. Maybe it's who attended that school that you think is interesting. Maybe you know someone who went to that school or through that program. Maybe you have a connection to the faculty. Or maybe it's the number of students they graduate that's so impressive, or the location of their clinical sites. Whatever it is, make yourself a list so that you're prepared in your own mind to answer that question. You don't have to bring the list with you, but once you identify them, you know, try to commit those to memory. I really like this school's location. I like that they've been around for this number of years, or that the faculty or staff has a long tenure there, that most of the faculty have been there a long time. That could be something that you really like. It could be that you like how they arrange their cohorts, or what they've said in terms of how they support the cohort. Whatever it is, you want to just make your quick list, and you want to be sure that that at least one of the pieces of information, one of the reasons, is something that's not on the first or second or third page of the school's website.
Now, Lisa, what if the answer is, I picked this school because it's 30 minutes from my boyfriend's house, or my parents live here and I can live in the basement while I'm going to school? Are those too personal of answers, or are those acceptable answers?
I think the best way to answer when it's someone you have from your personal life who's able to house you during the time is you can say family, you can say close family. I would recommend against specifics, my mom, my boyfriend, my cousin, identity, our disabilities, really where we live, how we get to work, how we get to school. Those things are not allowed to be considered for most interviews by law. So keeping that in mind, you don't have to disclose whether or not you have children. That is of no concern to the school. The more information you provide of your personal life that's not required is more for the interviewers to bring bias into their decision. And so your part as the interviewee is to protect them from that bias as well by not revealing those details, because it really is none of their business. Who you're with, what is their business is, are you a viable candidate to successfully complete the program? So what they're looking for is substance, not necessarily proof, but substance that will demonstrate that you can successfully complete the program. So if the answer is, my boyfriend lives close to this school, so that's very convenient to me, and it will give me a good excuse to move in with my boyfriend, which is what I want to do anyway, you're not going to say all that. You're going to say, I have a family member who lives close by this school, and we have a really good relationship, and I am assured a place to stay. And that's sufficient. They don't need to know the gender of that person or anything beyond that.
Okay. Perfect. I like that. I think that's very helpful. And I know personally that's a question that would trip me up. I have a tendency to overshare. So
me too.
Yeah.
We all do. I think over or under, right? Which is why I made sure to point out that this is what they're looking for. So they want you to demonstrate how you're going to support yourself throughout the program.
Yeah. So saying I have a family member nearby and I'm assured a place to live, it answers all their questions without oversharing. I think it's a perfect balance and an important distinction from any other answer that I would have considered giving. So yeah. Okay. What about the next one? What will you do if you don't get into our program? How would you answer that?
Again, here's an answer that begs you to be vulnerable and go to a dark, sad place in your mind. Look for the fear. What are you going to do if you don't get what you want? And so finding a positive ending to that answer is critical. They're going to look for, what are you going to do? They're asking what you're going to do. They're not asking how you're going to feel. They're not asking where you're going to go. They're not asking who you're going to talk to. They're asking, what are you going to do? And so you should have a game plan. And part of the answer to this question may be to help them gauge how into their school you are versus other programs. So you want to be mindful of that. and focus on what you're going to do if you don't get on that in that program for real. Will you be applying to other schools? If you already have applied to other schools, then the way to talk about that is to say, I have a backup plan in place, and so I have applications into a couple other schools, and it doesn't matter how many, it's none of their business. I have applications into a couple other schools that are my second choice if I don't get into this program. Mm-hmm. And because I'm going to become a CRNA, you know, one way or the other, yeah. This is my goal and I'm going to reach my goal. Again, this is what they're looking for, that you're determined no matter what.
Because if you're not determined, it's less likely you're going to finish their program, even if they do admit you. So that matters. I like that answer. Okay. What about the next one? Why pick you? Why should I pick you out of so many other candidates? We're interviewing 80 people today. There's only 20 spots in the program. Why do I pick you over somebody else?
This is a great question. It's asked frequently, and it is a challenge to your determination, your preparedness, and how committed you are to reaching this goal. So this is your perfect opportunity to say, with confidence but without arrogance, you're going to talk about how you get things done. I am someone who completes what I start. I am someone who finishes wherever I start, I finish. I have these kinds of systems or tools in place to help me pace myself. You're going to demonstrate how you're going to complete the program. I know it sounds redundant, but this is what they're looking for. How are you going to complete the program? And why they should pick you is because you are so determined and committed to completing this program with high marks and going out and being the best CRNA the world ever saw. That's what they're looking for. And you can say these things, again, with confidence without sounding arrogant, by focusing on how you get things done.
Great. So the biggest, the biggest thing they're looking for is, do you finish what you start? Because if you can get decent grades and finish their program, then they're going to want to admit you because that makes them look good. They want high pass rates and they want low attrition rate. Those are the two metrics that matter.
That's right.
So
if you've been through an accelerated program in the past, you can share that as an example. They like that a lot. If you can share about a time when maybe you had to have two jobs, or when you were working your way through nursing school, talk about those times where you were maxed out in a similar way to get something done under pressure that took some time, that took more than a day, right? You had to endure and overcome and persevere and in order to complete it. You want to give those examples if you have them.
Now, Lisa, kind of a tangent off this question. I've coached several people now who have kind of shadow in their past where maybe they took a nurse. It's very common for people to take a nurse practitioner program before they go to a CRNA program for different reasons. Sometimes they're trying to boost their GPA or to show that they can do graduate level classes, and they think, well, as long as I'm doing graduate level classes, I may as well be working towards a degree just in case I want to finish it. And then they don't finish it. So I've talked to so many people now who have started nurse practitioner programs, have not finished, and now they're applying to CRNA school. So how can they overcome that specific objection of having failure? And I say that with air quotes, you know, they didn't finish, right. And now you're trying to convince them that, yes, I'm going to finish. How can they do that? It sounds like a tricky situation.
Right. Well, it will depend on the truth of why they didn't complete that other program. But the most common reason in my mind will be because they got into the program and realized that it wasn't enough for them, that they wanted a more rigorous program from what they're doing in their current role. Or perhaps they were pursuing that as the logical next step because they didn't know what the other options were. That is something that happens. And I think to be prepared to answer that question in when those things do exist is, this is one of those negative stories. So we're going to not have a villain or a victim or a bad guy, because it could be that the program wasn't right for you. maybe there wasn't support in place, maybe they weren't as careful in their selection process to make sure that all of the students they accepted were viable to complete the program successfully. You can say anything like that where that you weren't sure. It doesn't hurt to point out how much time has gone by between now and then when that thing happened and where you were in your life. Maybe your life situation was different. And sharing those details goes into that personal area where, again, people can be mostly anonymous because it's not a story about them. It's about you and being challenged to complete a program that you started. And I think oftentimes people feel so much shame or regret or embarrassment over their failure that it's hard for them to talk about that and put it in the positive. So the positive must be the gratitude for getting put on the path to CRNA, because that's the holy grail, right? That's now your goal and your objective, and back to your why, and your why feeding into why you're here and how it's different from where you were before.
I like that. And I think anytime you can throw in some gratitude, it will only benefit you, because all the books I've read, all the research shows gratitude is so hugely beneficial to anyone you share it with. So in an interview, you know, if you can show gratitude for anybody in your past, for them at the moment, you know, for the path to CRNA, for how this can help you in your future, it just makes you more likable and it encourages them. They feel happy in your presence. They're more likely to, you know, to like you and have a good impression of you. So I love that piece about gratitude and kind of infusing that anywhere that you can. On to the next question, which is work history, do's and don'ts. I'm going to share a little bit about what they're looking for when they ask you about your work history. So one of the biggest mistakes you can make is by sharing that you have experience that you don't really have. So let's say you've been in a CVICU for 2 years and you spent 1 week maybe floating, maybe the hospital was in a bind, you floated to some other ICU and you got a little bit of experience there. Mostly it was exposure, but you don't know anything in depth in that unit or department. I wouldn't even mention that experience. If you want to throw it out there, say, you know, I did spend a week becoming acquainted with this type of ICU. But it's definitely not my specialty. You know, where I feel most confident is with this CVICU that I've been at for 2 years. These are the types of equipment that I worked with. These are the types of patients that I saw. And you want to really rein in those parameters, because whatever you tell them about your experience, they're going to assume that you're an expert in that area. And they will grill you with very detailed clinical questions to find the edges of your knowledge. So if you do what some people have done, which is be overconfident or kind of brag off the bat, like, oh, I've got experience in this and that, and you really make it sound like you're an expert, they're going to find out that you're not, and you're not going to feel very good about that. It's not going to go well. So I guess only present the experience that you have and know that you're going to get grilled for everything you say. So go into it knowing that and be careful with your answers. So there's only two more questions left. And the next one is political issues. A lot of times they'll ask you to share what you know about what's going on in the anesthesia community. So Lisa, what's the best strategy for knowing all this? If you're just preparing a week or two, three weeks before the interview, what can you do to know enough to be able to answer this confidently?
Sure. Well, there's a great tool in Google that I like, and it's called Google Alerts. So if you have a Gmail, you can go into Google Alerts and you can put in a search for anesthesiology, and you don't even have to do more than anesthesiology, and hit save, and Google will actually email you articles it finds on the web from that day moving forward. So it's something you could turn on for a couple weeks and see. You can skim the news, what's happening in the world where anesthesiologists, actually is a better word to search on, to see when they come into play in the news. And so that's one way to do it. And associations, Joy, you have all the details on the associations for CRNAs. That's a really good place, because they'll have those issues that are most relevant. they'll have those mm-hmm. usually on their homepage or in their blog. They'll have them right up front, because that's one of the benefits of being in the association, is that they're curating that news for you to stay abreast of things that are going on in your industry.
That's right. And that would be the AANA, or the American Association of Nurse Anesthetists. So definitely go to their website, check it out. So some things to pay attention to, Lisa mentioned anesthesiology. It is important to know what types of conflicts there are between anesthesiologists and nurse anesthetists, and then in which states you can practice as a CRNA and have autonomy, and which states you need to be supervised by an anesthesiologist. You really want to know those cultural is the right word, but there are a lot of different regional, that's the word I'm looking for, regional anesthesia, because it's different. It's different when you're in a rural area versus a city. Sure. Anesthesia is just different everywhere you go around the states. And also this is important to know just for your own sake, when you graduate, what state do you want to work in? There's very different work environments in different states. And I know that one of the main reasons that people become a CRNA is for the autonomy. Well, you don't have autonomy in every state. And some states, they have kind of a different culture, and I'm just going to leave it at that. So, ask around, ask if you know a CRNA, ask them what some of the issues that they are facing or have faced in the past. There's a lot you can learn. Also go to allnurses.com or nurseanesthesia.org and surf the forums there on issues. People tend to be complaining about the same things at the same time. And, people who are in the know and have been in the industry for decades, we'll know a lot more than you do. So, go ahead and see what they know, so that you can be up on that a little bit more. And I think that research will do you well. The last question we have is questions to ask the school. So that's always, the last question. Well, do you have anything, these are all the questions we had for you. Do you have any questions for us? So, Lisa, what would you say are the general guidelines for asking questions to schools? And then I'll share a few tips that I have.
Sure. Well, I think the big three are, you can ask about their career services, job placement, coaching support for once you graduate. It's very safe and a good quality question to ask about their alumni programs. How involved people are. Are there events? Is there a newsletter? Is there a way to stay in touch afterwards? And it's also good to ask about the logistics of the cohort. So you can reference what you've seen on the website or your invitation information already, where you know what they've got in place, but maybe there's more. Maybe there's more to do with staying connected with your classmates, your cohort throughout the program, and asking more details about that.
Those are some questions that we can ask the program. So what I'm going to touch on is how do you ask that question? So coming from the book, How to Negotiate as If Your Life Depends on It, Never Split the Difference is the title. He talks about how do you word questions in a way that opens people up instead of closes them down. So you want to avoid questions that start with why. People tend to feel defensive when they're asked a question that starts with why. So you want to start a question with what and how. Those are the two best words at the beginning of a sentence when you're asking somebody else a question. It's open-ended and it's non-threatening. So what can I expect from blah, 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 or how do most students experience this, or how, I don't know the specific questions you would ask, but you could start them with what and how, and you could think things through and rehearse, the questions that you would have on your mind to ask them. But you want to make sure it's non-threatening, that it's open-ended, and that you're never going to ask a question that's going to stump the interviewer. You don't want to ever make them feel like they don't know the answer. So this should be an easy question for them to answer, and something that initiates bragging, that gets them to talk about their school and how great it is, because that's going to make them feel good. And that's one of our goals, is to make them feel comfortable, to feel positive, to feel good about themselves, because then they'll, in turn, like us more. I'm going to close this out by saying that there's, so far what we've covered is a lot of general information on how to prepare for an interview. And if you do the things that we've talked about, you will have a better chance of doing well in the interview. However, it would be foolish to think that these answers are going to make the difference for you. They might make a difference, but every person comes with their own set of baggage, with their own set of, you know, their own blind spots. So Lisa has coached so many people at this point, and she's noticed that every time she coaches, people come with different issues that they specifically need to address, blind spots that they have. And without her coaching, they would have never seen it. And sometimes we have a hard time self-identifying. We might hear some advice and not realize that it applies to us, or because we're so, I don't know, self-conscious or insecure, we might over-apply the advice to us. And so maybe we have a tendency to be shy and quiet and have a hard time speaking. And then we hear advice saying, oh, you know, you don't want to brag about yourself. Don't talk too much. Be calm and quiet, you know, and then we might overdo it and go in the opposite direction, if that makes sense. So it's really important to get specific feedback about the areas that you specifically might struggle in. Maybe your issue is that you boast a lot, or that it's all about you and you're going to talk, you know, if you get to the interview without some type of personal guidance, you might just go on and on and on about you, and it might bore the interviewers and they might not want you in the program just for that reason. So it's hard for us to identify when we're doing those things because we're not objective about ourselves. So yeah, I would encourage you to get a personal interview with Lisa Evans, to put that on your calendar, to prioritize that. Because if you think about it, especially if you only have two or three schools to choose from, and especially if you care about the region of where you're applying. So let's say you're interview deadline or your, I'm sorry, application deadline is in the fall. So you apply to your schools and let's say, you know, you slip up and you screw up in the interview and you don't get in. Now you have to wait an entire year. Wouldn't it have been better to pay a couple $100 to talk to someone ahead of time who can help you specifically address your specific issues so that when you go to that interview, you're as prepared as you possibly can be. And you can put your best foot forward and you might even get into school an entire year earlier because of that help. I would encourage you, you know, and if you don't go with Lisa, at least go with someone, you know, at least do a mock interview with someone that you know. And I would encourage you to pick someone that you don't know very well, that you don't have a close relationship with, because it's so easy to feel comfortable and to not have those annoying habits. You know, we're not going to feel nervous around our significant other or our siblings or our parents. You know, we feel so comfortable with them. We're not going to present the same way. You really need to be around someone who you feel awkward around, someone who's in a higher rank than you. I mean, as many things as you can line up that's going to be similar to the interview, and as much as you can practice that ahead of time. Again, what Lisa said earlier about the brain is that we have to know things. The brain wants to know the answer. And when we don't know, we oftentimes put in worst case scenarios, and that's never going to be helpful to you in an interview setting. You want to already feed it those positive outcomes. You want to be, you know, having that best case scenario, feeling confident, knowing that you can do this. So if you do need some extra help and you want to have the best possible chance of getting accepted this year and not having to wait for a whole nother year, I would just invite you to see if you can get a personal interview with Lisa Evans and see how she can coach you and help you specifically to really put your best foot forward on this next interview. So thanks again, everyone, for your time.